Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at TiltUK.
Hello, you're listening to Tilt at the Mill. I'm Mark Thompson here with you for the next hour. I think we'll start again. I did try to start exactly at 5:30, but I think there was some sort of problem. So let's go again. If you want to get in touch, you're on Twitter at TiltUK or I'm at Mark Reckons. You can tweet me your thoughts. You can also email me on markreckons@live.co.uk. Later, I'll be talking to Gavin Devine about whether pensioners should have the vote. Yeah, you heard right. Pensioners should have the vote. That's a debate that's seriously being had. So Gavin wrote a piece for the Huffington Post the other day, which I found quite intriguing. The idea that we could disenfranchise everyone who's retired. He does have method in his madness, though, so we'll be unpicking that with him just after nine. But first, I'm very pleased to be joined by Sean Kemp, who is a former special advisor to Nick Clegg while he was Lib Dem leader and also Deputy Prime Minister. Good evening, Sean.
Good evening.
Have you ever had anything go wrong like that in Downing Street?
I've had so many things go wrong in Downing Street, it's almost impossible to sort of start listing them all.
Okay, I thought maybe we'd just make you feel at home by just having a bit of a cock-up right at the start. So before we get into that, actually, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up being a special advisor to Nick Clegg as Deputy Prime Minister and working in Downing Street? Because obviously that's quite an unusual and high-profile position to be in. I'm just quite curious as to how people like yourself kind of found themselves in that position.
Well, I'm quite an unusual person in how I ended up doing it, because I basically asked for a job out of the newspaper. I was a journalist, mainly working online, worked at the Evening Standard, the Independent, and so on, and I'd always wanted to be a political journalist, actually. I was obsessed by politics since I was a kid. I remember being like, 12 and sort of poring over election results and so on.
Sounds like me.
I was just a political geek, basically. Always had been wanting into journalism. I'd worked in journalism for quite some time. Was getting a bit bored of it, particularly the online stuff, because at that time, really, on news websites weren't really particularly well funded. They couldn't get any money out of them. And I literally just saw a job out in the garden to go and work in the Liberal Democrat press office, which I went and did in 2006.
Were you a member of the Lib Dems at the time?
No, I wasn't. But what it said in the advert and what it said in the sort of job description for it was you must be sympathetic to the aims and ambitions of the Liberal Democrats. And I remember when they asked me about this in my interview, I sort of said, well, everyone's sympathetic to the Liberal Democrats, aren't they? Which they consider to be a sort of good enough answer. So I wasn't a member, I voted for them at the previous election because, frankly, I was a sort of classic sort of civil libertarian type. I sort of lost patience over things like ID cards and so on. Now, that's quite an unusual way, though, to get into sort of politics like that. The sort of, you see a job ad, there's an open interview process, you apply. Most people, to be frank, the sort of cliche of people getting intern jobs and going and working for the party and working for an MP and sort of going up via that route, often by who they know, frankly, is still the way it tends to work quite a lot.
Yeah, because the feeling I get is generally people in the kind of position you were in have been in or around the party for decades, like since they were basically students in short pants.
I think that's true. The difference with the Liberal Democrats, I think, was, in a sense, numbers. They always isn't the same. If you look at Labour and Tories and the much larger memberships they have, much easier for them, for example, to do what I was doing, a sort of spinners-type job, sort of spin-doctory-type thing. Yeah, there are journalists you know who can do it, and so on and so forth. It was less so with the Lib Dems. So there was always a mix of people who are real, you know, lifelong party activists, been doing it since year dot, and then people like myself, people like another special advisor to Nick called Lena Peach, who... was somebody just basically applied on spec, having been sort of a broadcast journalist, and they sort of took her in. So we had sort of quite a good mix, which is, I think, actually healthy, because in politics, if everyone has just drunk the Kool-Aid a little bit too much, you can all sit around going, oh, yeah, this is a really great idea, isn't it? Well, you know, everyone must be fascinated by, you know, proportional representation being a classic example of the Lib Dems. And
are they not? Because I'm still labouring.
They're not. And I was for a long time as that sort of slightly more outsidery type. I was often the person in the room would go, but I don't actually think this is going to get much coverage. I don't think people really care about this. You know, about land value taxation or whatever the latest thing was.
Actually, we covered that on this show a few weeks ago.
But I think that was always helpful to me, to be a sympathetic voice, but also a slightly outsidery voice to try and sort of keep us on track.
Try and stop the dreaded groupthink.
Yes, yeah, but I mean, that always filters in over time, sadly, in politics, but yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of how you found yourself there. I mean, did you So you obviously worked for the party for a few years.
Yeah.
Did you have any inkling that they were likely to end up in coalition? Because obviously it hadn't happened for many decades. And although the polls were indicating that that was what was quite likely to happen, I mean, certainly from my perspective, I was a member of the Lib Dems at the time, and I didn't really believe it was actually going to happen.
I didn't think it would happen. There was preparation that was done in Parliament. So things like, you know, they did do a sort of dry run of how the coalition negotiations could work, for example. The manifesto in sort of 2010 was designed with coalition negotiations in mind, the sort of four main policy platforms on the front cover. The idea was that's what we'll definitely try and negotiate. There'd been some thinking. I don't think many people really, really believed it was going to be a hung parliament. I mean, you can see, for example, the positions we got ourselves on things like tuition fees and so on. If we really seriously, really, throughout the whole party, thought this is going to happen, I think we'd have done something differently. And I know Nick, if I'm honest, didn't expect it to be 2010. I think he expected it to be the election after 2010, which is, I think if you look at everything that was going on in the party at the time, we were sort of halfway down the route of getting ready for it being a party that went into a coalition government. We weren't all the way there, and I think that's what it sort of hit us like a truck, actually, the first sort of 6 months to a year of being in government, even to people like us who are, you know, political obsessives and all the rest of it. When you're actually in it and doing it, it's so new. It's so unlike anything else you've done. It took us ages to sort of find our feet. And so I think we sort of said, oh, we had a really good chance. I think deep down, most people thought the Tories would win a small majority and we'd get into a coalition government next time.
So you actually worked in Downing Street and you actually sat in the same office as a load of Tories, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was like the sort of uber coalition special advisor, because there were two Lib Dems and three Conservatives all in one office in Downing Street. The idea being that, I mean, this is sort of very early, in the very early days in particular, we were quite keen for there not to be sort of lots of stories about splits, because we thought people weren't used to coalition government and we should try and avoid that if we could. With hindsight, frankly, I think that was a mistake. That's how we felt at the time. And it was the Conservatives also felt that way, because like Andy Coulson were quite like, we will have to try and make sure we sort of sound like it's sort of a bit more united. The idea was, if we all sat in one office, we couldn't all insult the other person's party on the phone to journalists, because we'd all be sitting in front of each other. I mean, obviously what actually happened was we all found our own little personal cubby holes around Downing Street, and every time the phone rang, I'd sort of run off to a little cupboard where they kept all the old newspaper clippings and do all my briefing from there, frankly. The idea was we all sort of sat together, so we all sort of, two meetings a day, we'd all sort of go over what was going on. And it was funny how quickly everyone's guards came down. So after about 2 weeks, we were all gossiping about each other's MPs. And I remember after a while, we had a sort of conversation. We were like, well, should we stop this? Because, frankly, can we all trust each other? And we quickly reached the conclusion that basically it'd be like mutually assured destruction. If any of us ever said what had been talked about amongst us in Downing Street, the other side would do the same, and we'd just sort of lay waste to each other's path. And so we all had to sort of bite our tongues. Even now, the things they said about Nadine Dorris that I will not repeat. But
I don't think anyone who knows a bit about politics would be surprised to hear that, to be honest.
No, probably not.
Okay, so... that's kind of the background of how you got there and a little bit about the, you know, the kind of the structural setup. I mean, how did you find being a special advisor to the Deputy Prime Minister? Because presumably the level of responsibility and the level of pressure and focus that was on you and what you were doing was many orders of magnitude higher than anything that you'd done before.
Yeah, the pressure was extraordinary. I think particularly coming from the Liberal Democrats, where, because I did a lot of my time was more media focused. Sort of the politics and the medium. And if you're at the Lib Dems, you're used to, like, you really have to jump up and down to get attention before you go into government. Like, no one would write about us. And all of a sudden, like, you could make a mistake and it would be front page news.
Yeah.
And that was a cultural change. I mean, and some of that was good. You know, it was fun, frankly, to be able to occasionally leak stuff and brief stuff and it to be big and, like, it's good. It was fun, good for your ego. But the stress of it is extraordinary. And I remember when I started at Downing Street, somebody still a very good friend of mine, a civil servant there, who was a very good friend as well, Damien McBride.
Oh, yeah.
And we went to the pub after a couple of weeks, and she said, I'm going to give you one piece of advice. She said, and it's leave after 3.5 years. And after 3.5 years, you all go mad. And, you know, strangely enough, you can sort of feel it after about 3.5 years. Like, you just don't get weekends. You don't really get evenings because the phone's always going. Particularly things like Twitter. Now, you know, if you're working in government, particularly in Downing Street, where everything basically is your issue, there's always five or six stories that you're having to deal with and arguments you're having with journalists and MPs. You're trying to have to make, say something, and it is relentless. I mean, in the end, that's why I left. I did it for 4 years, and I left, basically, because, you know, I wanted to get married and have a normal life and be able to go on holiday and so on. So it's incredibly stressful, but it's also amazingly good fun, just fascinating to watch. And it's a privilege. I mean, it's just extraordinary, because you get to sit there and, to some extent, sort of see history being made. You get to see the budgets being put together and decisions about foreign policy, and you can sort of sit there and be in the room for them. So for someone like me, who's obsessed by politics, you know, you walk in through the black door every morning. I'd find myself occasionally sort of sitting in the back during cabinet meetings. It's just extraordinary. You'd have to pinch yourself.
So you actually sat in on cabinet meetings?
Yes. So you can start and sit in. So you all sort of sit around the back like little school children and sort of sit there. And obviously you can't say anything. You just sort of sit there and sort of nose and watch sort of. It's just intriguing to watch. Like everyone, every time Owen Paterson speaks, everyone rolls their eyebrows, and yeah, and so rolls their eyes rather than rolls their eyebrows. That'd be weird. You know, people like Michael Gove kind of smuggling snacks and eating them under the table and so on. That's what I always found most fascinating about it, is that everyone basically acting like they are at other jobs. Like cabinet was basically like a very long, boring work meeting, where they're checking their phones and so on.
Were you there at the cabinet meeting where Chris Hughne threw the No to AV campaign literature across the desk at George Osborne and demanded that he distance himself from it?
I wasn't. I was in Downing Street, and I remember it because I remember all the Tories coming in and saying, basically, you have to sort out Chris Hughne because you will not believe what he's done.
He sorted himself out in the end, didn't he?
Yeah, he did sort himself out, but that was completely deliberate. I mean, the thing about Chris was he was one of these politicians who was sort of, he liked the big gestures, and knew exactly what he was doing. He was trying to get coverage for it. I was just talking to a fellow ex-special advisor today, actually, about my favourite Chris Hughne moment, because he was a sort of persistent briefer and leaker and so on. And I always remember when he once accidentally, he was trying to text a journalist, he actually tweeted, like, you know, he tweeted something like, oh, yeah, very good, publish tomorrow, but make sure my fingerprints aren't all over it. And I remember sort of, Chris, what have you just placed in the Guardian?
So he did that. He put that on Twitter rather than
the
text message.
Yeah, he put that on Twitter. So he thought he was texting it, and he just sort of published it for the entire. And obviously, he retweeted about 500 times.
Oh, he didn't get away with that. Well, is that?
No, he didn't get away with that one.
Even if he deleted it, I think there's an account, or at least there used to be, that used to go around retweeting things that MPs had deleted.
Yeah, and also, you know, you learn this in SPAD, you do all the dirty tricks. The moment an MP says something, they'll screen grab it before they can realise it would be a terrible, terrible mistake they've made.
Absolutely. So presumably that's not the worst problem, cock-up mistake that you encountered during your time then?
No, that's not the worst. It's a classic example of the sort of, the ones I always remember, the mistakes, so the big serious ones, like, you know, tuition fees for Lib Dems, which is the one that still I'll wake up in the middle of the night and sort of tearing my hair out about, to be honest. The things I remember most are, I remember once one of our MPs, the BBC, ringing him up to interview him live on Radio 4 and ringing the wrong number and getting a builder in Liverpool who then pretended to be the MP and resigned live on air. I remember that incredibly clearly. And like literally going into the Whip's office, and it was Mike Crockhart, Scottish MP, going into the Whip's office, in the Liberal Democrat Whip's office in Parliament, and him being there. And I'm saying, Mike, you just resigned on the radio. And he's like, no, I've been in the meeting. What are you talking about? That was a particularly good one. Just some builder who's fed up with the BBC ringing the wrong number.
So he'd had phone calls before and he just decided.
Yeah, he had phone calls before, and eventually this guy, it's literally a builder who's on like scaffolding, so paper tracked him down afterwards. And his patience just snapped. So he said, yeah, fine. And then he was sort of did his live interview. He was quite good, actually. And then for about 5 minutes, he was like, yeah, I've just had enough. It's all these broken promises. I'm done. I'm resigning.
Brilliant. I wasn't aware of that one.
No, but I mean, I always think, there's so many like, sort of mistakes and other things that sort of happen. I remember whenever I hear sort of someone talk about sort of conspiracy theories, sort of imagining the government is plotting this and they've briefed that, so they'll cover up for this thing and all the rest of it. I always remember sitting in Downing Street in 2012, we just had the Omni shambles budget, we'd all gone terribly wrong. People were being asked, you know, every politician in Britain was being asked when they last ate a pasty or a sausage roll, and David Cameron had just got it wrong. And I remember Francis Maude had just done an interview where he advised everyone to fill up their jerry cans with petrol, and a woman had sort of set herself on fire. And I remember it just being complete chaos and anarchy. And I remember just sort of sitting there and saying to my Tories, like, anyone who ever thinks there is some sort of, you know, there's some small collective group of masterminds in Downing Street who know who are pulling every string around the country, they can actually see what's happening, which is basically a load of people running around desperately trying to get through to the end of the day without something else disastrous happening. That would be completely, all that notion of conspiracy theories would vanish overnight, I promise you.
I remember, I can't remember which politician it was now, but one of the many, many memoirs that I've read, some politician said something along the lines of, you know, they spent their childhood and early adulthood assuming and thinking that there were people who were running everything, who knew exactly what they were doing, and it was all under control. And then the more senior they got within politics, the more they started to realise that just wasn't true at all.
I remember one of Gordon Brown's special advisors once said to me, you always think that there is, like, there's a door, and behind that door are the people who really are running it. And then you end up in Downing Street, and you're like, no, there really isn't. It's us. Mm. You know, and it's interesting you say about the memoirs, because I think political memoirs fall into two camps. There are the honest ones that sort of make that point. Then there are the revisionist ones, where they all sort of retrospectively say how it was all part of some grand plan. That's why I've sort of given up reading political memoirs now, because having seen how it actually works, or half of them, I mean, Mandelson's one particularly extraordinary example, you just think, as close to fiction as is possible to get, you know? Not as smooth as you're imagining.
I think the best political memoirs are like the Alan Clarks, the Chris Mullins, the Giles Brandreths, actually.
The best ones are always the people who are just a little bit outside it.
Yeah.
And they've just been able to see the slight comedy of everything that's going on. Mm. One exception I make is the Alistair Campbell diaries, which are just, because he wrote them at the time and just chucked everything down there, they do capture a little bit more the sort of chaos of it all. But yeah, I mean, the people who write things sort of 10 years later and sort of, like Jack Straw's, like, Wales, writing out everything, essentially, it's his memoir, are just absurd. They're just exercising it all, trying to sort of protect your reputation.
I think I've got Jack Straw's memoir. I think it's called Last Man Standing. I've never actually read it, though. It's on the bookshelf, so, you know, it makes me look all erudite, but... I'm not sure I'll ever bother reading it. So, obviously, we've talked about, like, cock-ups and so forth, but there must have been some good stuff that you did and that you're proud of. I mean, what would you say maybe the two things you're most proud of from the time that you were there?
Well, I mean, the thing that I'd always say I'm most proud of is actually just before Coalition, which is I worked on the debate. I was responsible for writing what we called the debate book, which is basically the big script for Nick for when he was doing those 2010 TV debates.
Really?
That first debate where the amazing polls came in, it was extraordinary. It was literally, everyone in Westminster was obsessed by the West Wing. And they always act like they're in the West Wing, even as sort of anarchy is descending around them. It's literally the only moment in my life where I was like, this is like that episode of the West Wing. Like, we've just trounced everyone in the poll, and we're in the spin room, and we don't need to say anything. We could just walk out now, which is what we did. We just went, we're off, bye. And that will always be just one of those amazing moments.
Yeah, I mean, whose idea was it for Nick Clegg to look directly at the camera and to be addressing people in the audience by their names and all that stuff?
The director at the camera, I think it was Lena Peach, who was one of the special advisors.
Yeah.
It was kind of a collective thing, because what you do is you rehearse, obviously, then you watch back sort of the video footage.
Mm.
So, and I think, and we were trying different ways of doing it, and then we did try this, just keep looking down the camera, which is what politicians do for speeches and so on, when it's an important bit, they look down the camera.
Mm.
And remember, we all watched the video footage, and the next time we came in for the next rehearsal, and that just, it felt so much better on telly than it did in the room. In the room, it looked weird.
Mm.
The names, I can't remember. I remember that was pretty much on the, I think that was on the morning of the first debate we ended up doing that.
Mm.
Once again, it was a rehearsal, we're just trying to work out what the best way to do it. And we would have sort of all members of staff sort of sitting around and going, hello, I'm Doris from Basildon, I want to ask you about this.
Mm.
And once again, we tried every single way of answering it, but it was, I mean, what became obvious was, if you watch Question Time, it always strikes me as well, if a politician doesn't answer the question quite early on, the camera then cuts to the member of the audience looking grumpy. If you're watching at home, you're like, oh, you're not answering the question. And our thing was always, for all those debates, was that you have to get permission to then sort of say all the other stuff you want to say.
Mm.
So for the first 20 seconds, address the person who asked you the question, answer it, and then do... You know, then say, but the other issue to think about is, you know, X, Y, Z. A lot of times politicians, they get asked a question, then they'll sort of instantly start sort of chuntering on, saying, well, that's not what people want to know about. And it's not what they did, they just asked you. That's always my particular least favourite.
Mm. Yeah, I had a very, very slight role in the debates, not in the debates, but in the media coverage afterwards, because for the final one, I was part of Radio 5 Live panel.
Mm.
that were kind of discussing it afterwards, and I got the biggest laugh I've ever got. Well, I don't often have an audience when I'm doing radio stuff, but there was actually a live audience there, and me, and it was Ian Dale, who was there for the Tories, and Will Straw was there for Labour, so we each had to pretend to play our respective party leaders. So I was pretending to be Nick Clegg, and we kind of acted out this bit where people ask questions, and I got a huge laugh by just doing that thing that Clegg had done in all the debates, which was, I'm sorry, can you just move, I can't quite see, you know, that bit where he'd kind of point them out and just try and repeat the name over and over again. So there was a definite meme thing that had kind of really chimed with people, the fact that they recognised that. I mean, that was obviously just before the election, and that, I mean, the whole kind of Clegg surge thing that then, I mean, it never quite translated into votes and seats, no. Unfortunately. But in terms of your time actually whilst in power, what would you say is the biggest thing that you're most proud of in terms of achievements? Necessarily have to be something that you personally did.
I think the things that Lib Dems more generally, it's to be honest, it's still hard to look back at it all, because at the end of it, you just think about the sort of catastrophically bad result in 2015. It's all tainted by that a little bit. I do think the things that I will look back on to be honest, it's not the things that we briefed about or I leaked a particular story or any of that nonsense. The really boring, and this is worthy answer, is things like the income tax threshold and pupil premium and policies like that, which I think were good and made a difference. And also, this is a slightly churlish political point, but we did spend 5 years locked in really bitter rows with the Tories, trying to stop them doing a load of things that they're doing now. And we probably didn't get credit for the time, because I don't think you get really credit for making things slightly less bad than they would otherwise be.
It's a very hard sell on the doorstep.
And I
speak from personal experience when I was still a member of the Lib Dems, trying to argue that on the doorstep, and people just aren't interested.
And I think that's one of the big mistakes we made, actually, to think in any way we could... You can't sell it. Until people see what the alternative is, they're not going to believe you.
Yeah.
But I do feel, actually, we did a lot of that, and we achieved a lot in stopping a lot of really bad... One for me I'm always really proud of, called the Beecroft Report, which I don't think people really remember now, but that was a report commissioned by George Osborne that basically recommended allowing bosses to be able to just sack people at will to remove all the employment protection. And that would have been, I think, a terrible, terrible piece of legislation. But that was we had to launch a sort of full-on sort of several months of background work against it, and I had to sort of keep on briefing journalists and leaking things about it, and eventually we did kill it. Now, it sounds odd to say you're proud of the things you stopped, but I'm proud that we helped stop that, because a load of people would be sacked for no good reason right now if we hadn't have done that. So there are those things, but if I'm honest, I always find I'm slightly... I still, in about 10 years' time, I'll maybe look back at it all and just feel happy. At the moment, I always think, oh, but what should we have done differently? What could we have done to stop what happened to us in the end?
I mean, that's an interesting point you made, actually. That was sort of going to be my final question. I mean, what do you think history will record about the time that the Lib Dems spent in government? Because, frankly, it's looking like it's not going to happen again for many, many, many years, if ever. So, I mean, how do you think they will record that time and record Nick Clegg's role in it?
I think it will probably be recorded as... I think it will be recorded as they did the right thing, going into government and trying to do the right thing in terms of what did on the economy and so on, but that we were horrifically politically naive, because I think we were, because you look at every example of the smaller party that goes in the coalition government throughout Europe, it's Angela Merkel, I think, said this, the smaller party always gets smashed, and we got smashed.
But usually under those in those other countries, it's under a more proportional system, which means although the smaller party might get smashed, they won't get almost completely wiped out.
Yeah, and we had sort of we weren't able to sort of change the rules of our own government with AV and so on, and we just we paid the penalty, and we made a lot of mistakes. I think particularly in the early days, I think we were too worried about making the coalition look unified. And that meant a lot of people made their minds up about us. And we were having furious rows in the background and then saying in public, oh, no, it's all fine, we're all one big team. Actually, I think people would have accepted us having big arguments quite early on. I think I'm saying that Vince Cable got right and sort of Nick Clegg got wrong, to be honest. Vince was much more right from the start that we don't pretend we like each other. This is a functional relationship. We sort of felt we could pretend to be really close and then slowly sort of distance ourselves. And you just can't do that. I think history will probably... I think it will look well at what we did in terms of doing the right thing by going to coalition government and providing a stable government, but I think it will probably say we were pretty politically naive in how we handled the early days and we paid the penalty.
Do you think that David Cameron and George Osborne, in a kind of Machiavellian way, sort of knew that that is what ultimately would happen to the Lib Dems and kind of played you in a way?
No, I don't. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying before about the sort of don't believe too many conspiracy theories. They didn't have an option. I think they genuinely felt, I think they felt if they go into coalition with the Lib Dems, it would be preferable to having to sort of keep on doing things to keep their backbenchers happy and trying to push through things, you know, with minority government and so on. I think they probably felt this would be a chance to be able to govern for a bit, look a bit more centrist. And then I'm sure that they then thought, and that would then, and then we'll hold an election, we've got more money, you know, we'll be able to, like, make gains of us. I don't think they imagined for a second they would sort of smash us. And actually, if I've spoken to sort of senior Conservatives since the election, and they were all expecting another coalition.
You can sort of tell that by what the Tory manifesto had in it and the problems Osborne's got now.
Yeah, it's loads of stuff that they promised because they thought we'd say, no, you're not doing that. and now they're sort of like, oh, no, we've got to actually deal with this rubbish. So I don't think they had quite that level of foresight. I mean, what's interesting now is that there'll be like Tories who come out and say, oh, no, yes, we did. We saw this come. And no, they didn't. That isn't how they looked at it at all. And I know because I worked with them for 4 years that they probably thought they'd be able to pick up a few of our MPs, partly through defections and partly through winning the seat. They didn't think they were going to sort of obliterate us in the way that happened.
Yeah. Okay, well, Sean, it's been fascinating to us. I mean, I could talk to you for another half an hour, frankly, but we need to go to a record and get our next guest on. But how can people get hold of you on social media and that sort of thing?
They can follow me on Twitter. I'm not trying to remember what I am on Twitter. I think I'm Sean_Kemp.
@Sean_Kemp, yeah.
I think that's right. And where I basically make sarcastic comments about politics on a fairly regular basis. other than that, I occasionally blog for the Times on their Redbox site.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye out for all that stuff. Thanks very much for your time this evening, Sean.
Nice to meet you.
Okay, so that's Sean Kemp, who was a special advisor to Nick Clegg during the coalition government.
Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.
Yes, you're listening to Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill for about the next 25 minutes. So we've just been talking to Sean Kemp about his time as a Lib Dem advisor to Nick Clegg when he was Deputy Prime Minister. We're going to change gear slightly now, and I'm delighted to be joined by Gavin Devine, who is a senior person within the PR industry, who recently wrote a piece for the Huffington Post, the nature of the piece that he wrote was somewhat controversial, and we'll try and unpack it a little bit here. The basic thesis was that we should stop pensioners from voting. Obviously, that makes it sound a little bit stark. Gavin, good evening, by the way.
Good evening, Mark.
do you want to just set out your thoughts just briefly so we can, you know, we can maybe unpack them a little bit?
Yes, of course. I mean, controversial is one word. I think provocative was more what I was aiming for. And it was to just give a sort of sense to a bit of framework around some frustration that I have, particularly around the European referendum, that the decision will be made disproportionately by people who are aged over 65, given the nature of voter turnout across the age groups. And in fact, obviously, you know, for something as long-term as a European referendum, those people will be affected far less than people like my 14-year-old daughter, who have no say in this at all. And I was really venting, I think, a sense of frustration. But there is a broader point, I think, about the fact that because young people don't turn out to vote in the same way that older people do, that unfortunately politicians are well used to pandering to them, and we end up in a sort of slightly chicken and egg situation where older people receive all the benefits, younger people feel disenfranchised, they don't turn out to vote. You end up increasingly giving things away to the elderly in a way that may or may not be fair, but it certainly isn't necessarily in the long-term interest of the country. And I guess that's really what my piece was about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I kind of zeroed in on the somewhat provocative idea that we could stop older people from voting, which maybe we'll come back to that in a minute. I mean, just on the broader issues here, I mean, this is something I've written about myself. I've talked about many times on the radio, actually, about young people not voting in high enough numbers and the things that you were referring to. I mean, you know, some concrete examples of how older people are pandered to, you know, the benefits that have been untouched, the universal benefits that they get, the free TV licences, the free bus passes, the triple lock that's now been applied to the state pension. And at the same time, you've got working age benefits that have been slashed. You've, you know, you've got child benefit frozen. You know, all of this stuff that's happening to younger people, and that yet older people aren't being touched. And I don't even necessarily think it's because we've got a Conservative government in, because I think even, say, if there was a Labour government, that they're subject to the same sort of pressures, because in the end, politicians have to respond to the incentives that the electorate put before them. And if the incentives are old people vote, young people don't vote, isn't it inevitable that you're going to get this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, this for me is not a party political point at all, because you're right. I mean, all parties quite naturally have pandered to the people who are most likely to vote, and why wouldn't they? And indeed, you know, whilst I believe very strongly we should stay within Europe, it's not really an in-out point either. The point is that the decision will be made disproportionately by people over the age of 65 who, you know, as I say in the piece, again, slightly provocatively, you know, will not be around to, or many of them will not be around to necessarily live with the consequences in the way that that a teenager will for the whole of their lives. So, you know, it is unfair to that extent. But as I say, you know, why wouldn't politicians do this? And it is chicken and egg. You know, if younger people turned out to vote rather more, then maybe politicians would start to listen to their voices. But equally, why would they turn out to vote when they don't feel that they're being listened to? So, you know, something's got to give on this, and I suspect it's the politicians in the middle who have to give. Who will have to show some leadership and actually start to make long-term decisions about the youth and the younger generation, things that will benefit over a longer period of time, rather than pandering in the short term to pensioners.
Yeah, I think you maybe are a little bit more optimistic than I am. I can't really see the mechanism that's going to be triggered that's going to make that happen, because, like you said, it's a kind of, you said chicken and egg, I'd maybe characterise it more like a kind of vicious circle of young people who aren't voting or voting in high enough numbers. They then see that the politicians are doing things that they're not happy with, and their response to that is to just think, well, they're all as bad as each other, I'm not going to bother voting, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And I struggle to understand what's going to break that cycle.
Oh, I think you can see how it could be broken. You know, if you look at Obama, for all the fact that Obama has been a disappointing president in many ways, you know, at least initially, he motivated and inspired significant numbers of younger people and other groups that traditionally in America had not voted, including ethnic minorities and others, to actually turn out and vote and get behind him and so on. You look at Jeremy Corbyn in this country, for all Jeremy Corbyn's, you know, manifest faults, which certainly can see very clearly, you know, he has motivated a certain group of people who, again, not necessarily traditionally been interested in politics or turned out to vote with quite the enthusiasm that that they're now displaying. I think it is possible to find political leaders who will inspire people who haven't turned out to vote, but politicians have to have to actually think that this is important and want to embrace it and see that there's some advantage for them in doing so. And there is some advantage for them in doing so, which is, you know, there are many millions of people aged between 18 and 35 or 18 and 45 who at the moment are not turning out to vote, and if they can be inspired to turn out to vote, would make a significant difference. You know, there is a reason why the Conservatives and indeed all of the Remain campaign are identifying specifically women. Well, obviously you would target women because, you know, we know that women from the Scottish referendum and many other similar decisions are the kind of people who vote to remain in things, remain in the Union, remain in Europe. So of course you target women, but the other group they're trying to target are people under the age of 45, because if you can get them to turn out, then the referendum should be a slam dunk. Whether that turns out to be the case is another matter.
Because there's this concern, isn't there, about differential turnout with the EU referendum, in that the people who are most likely to vote for Leave are the older generation, and the people most likely to vote for Remain are the younger generation.
Yeah, I mean, all the surveys show that. I mean, it's quite sort of shocking when you see the figures plotted out on a graph. You know, it sort of crosses over between Remain and Leave at about the age of 48. Well, I'm 45, so maybe I'm going to undergo some sort of conversion in the next 3 years. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at the polling, younger people disproportionately want to remain within the European Union, older people want to leave, but then you layer on the top of that the fact that only 50% of men aged 18 to 24, 39% of women that age voted in the 2010 general election, and by comparison it's about three quarters of men and women aged over 55. Well, once you layer that on top, then the vote Leave gets a significant boost.
Yeah, and I
and
think
as I say, I mean that is really unfair. And one of the things I found most disturbing about writing the piece that I wrote was I found myself agreeing with Nicky Morgan, which is not a phrase I ever thought I'd say. You know, in the sense that it is grossly unfair that the people who will be disadvantaged over the course of their whole lives are people like my teenage daughter, or indeed anybody under the age of 25, who at the moment has the prospect of being able to work in any European country that they want to work in, have the opportunity to share cultural experiences across that. You know, my daughter's only just come back from a school trip to Berlin, which, I mean, I'm sure will be possible under a Leave scenario, but will just be a little bit more difficult and a little bit less likely, a little bit more expensive. All of those benefits to the European Union, the soft cultural benefits, as well as the serious sort of economic and social benefit that we get from the European Union, will be lost to those people if people over the 65 and so on, who, frankly, in many, many cases, not all, in many cases are not really impacted by the European Union, other than in their own minds and in the pages of the tabloid newspapers that they read, could make a huge difference to generations of people who don't share the same view.
Yeah, and it, as you're talking about all of this, a few things are occurring to me. And the first one is, I was speaking to my father-in-law a few weeks ago, and he asked me, you know, he said, Mark, what do you think about the EU referendum? He knows I'm a bit kind of involved in politics and radio and stuff. And I gave him a little kind of 90-second spiel of why I think we should remain, although I'm not massively enthusiastic about it, but on balance, you know, I'm under 48, therefore I'm remain. And then he mentioned that everyone, well, not everyone, I think he said something like 85% of people in his golf club are for Leave. And I just kind of thought, well, yeah, but that's what you'd expect from the demographic of the kind of people in the golf club. You would expect that most of them are going to be for Leave. And what you said there about, the older people voting to Leave and it not particularly affecting them, I think not just because then, you know, someone who's 60, 70, 80 probably isn't going to be around in 20 or 30 years to really feel the full effects of having left the EU. But also the older people tend to be a lot better off anyway. They've probably paid off their mortgage. They may well be on a state pension that's, triple locked. So they're just not as likely to feel the problems if there are problems anyway, whereas the younger people are more likely. It's actually reminded me a little bit, and this isn't a perfect comparison, but the old political philosophy thing of the tyranny of the majority, where if you've just got 51, 52, 53% of the country, you think, do you know what, I want to leave, but maybe only 20% or 10% of the people who vote to leave are going to actually feel the effects of it, whereas maybe 80% of the people who vote remain will feel the effects of it. And maybe I'm exaggerating the numbers slightly there, but I think there is something in this that the people who are most likely to be affected by this are the ones who are least likely to vote. It's a very strange situation, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's actually worse than a tyranny of a majority, because it's going to be a tyranny of a minority. You know, all polls suggest that if you ask people straight out, do you want to remain in or do you want to leave, then remain has a majority. It's only when you then layer on, are you likely to actually turn out and vote, that it begins to look in any way different. So So in fact, it'll be a minority who make this incredible sort of decision that will change the future course of so much of the United Kingdom and so many aspects of people's lives. And I mean, you know, arguably that's the fault of younger people for not turning out to vote. But even so, there is something I think incredibly unfair about that. And the reason that I say older people are less affected is, you know, it's partly for the reasons that you've described, generally better off, generally in settled circumstances and so on. And believe me, I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know, there are gross generalizations to be made. You know, I happen to be lucky enough to live in, you know, a very nice corner of southwest Surrey. My parents and in-laws live in very similar circumstances. They're very, you know, very comfortably off. And I realize that's not the case for everybody. But certainly in their cases, because they are not of working age, so all of the benefits that exist for people of working age from being part of the European Union, including job opportunities, but also the opportunities to work abroad, to have free movement, to mix with other people in the workplace who come from other parts of the European Union, all of those sorts of things just don't apply to those people. Don't even begin to get me started on listening to people in southwest Surrey talking about how immigration is swamping us, whereas they sit in their lily white villages drinking in their pubs that have barely changed for the last 50 years.
Well, I live in a really nice part of Devon, and I there's a similar dynamic here as well.
Yeah, I mean there are. Again, there's plenty of polling that says that the people who care most about immigration tend to be people who live in places where immigration has been incredibly small. But anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked into a whole sort of immigration rant.
Yeah, please let us not.
But the simple fact is, I'm going to reduce my argument down to my mother-in-law. You've done your father-in-law. My mother-in-law, you know, who's in her 80s. May or may not, I don't know how she'll vote, but let's say she voted to leave the European Union. I mean, with the best will in the world, you know, she is living in very comfortable circumstances. Her lifestyle probably won't change very much between now and whatever time, I hope a long time in the future, when she departs this earth. I don't think it's entirely fair that she is given the same right to vote, or indeed my mother is given the same right to vote. And I have to say, I suspect that my mother and my mother-in-law will vote in opposite directions, not the first or the last time they've disagreed about stuff. But it's, I think it's really unfair that they're given the chance to vote and my teenage daughter is not. Now, I find it really surprising that the voting age for this wasn't reduced to 16, as it was in the case of the Scottish referendum. I think there's a good case for reducing it still further, and I particularly think there's a really good case for reducing the top age for voting, particularly on something as long-term as this.
Yeah, and that maybe comes to the crux of the piece that you wrote, because you did mention that. Just to digress slightly on the reducing to 16, I suspect that what happened, though, was that the Tories were torn, because I don't think... I think for this referendum, and David Cameron and George Osborne probably on balance would have liked to have reduced the voting age to 16, because that would have slightly tipped things further in Remain's direction.
Yeah.
But they would have set a precedent then. There would have been two referenda that had been held, one in Scotland and one nationwide, where people of the age of 16 and upwards were able to vote. And therefore, the calls for 16-year-old and 17-year-olds to be able to vote in general elections would probably become unanswerable, and that would not benefit the Tories. So I suspect there was some low politics going on there.
I think, and I say this as a lapsed member of the Conservative Party, I think it's about time the Conservatives had a little bit more confidence about where they stand and started to tell a story. I mean, you know, to go, as you say, to the crux of the issue, it's about time that all politicians began to tell a story that was a little bit more optimistic and about the future and about future generations, rather than trying to triangulate and pander to existing voting blocks who, frankly, are not going to be around forever.
Mm. Yeah, interesting point about, about that. And that does bring us to this question of, could we? is it possible? I mean, it almost felt more like a thought experiment than a serious suggestion in your piece, that we say pensioners aren't allowed to vote, maybe in general elections, but more specifically even if that didn't happen, for this referendum as a one-off thing to say, if you're of pensionable age, you're not allowed to vote in this referendum because you're not going to be around to see the consequences of it in 20, 30, 40 years' time. I mean...
And I mean, one of the things having flown the kite, I immediately said it ain't going to happen, and clearly it isn't. I mean, you know, as I said in the piece, turkeys don't vote for Christmas.
Okay, but let's just play it out as it.
On a matter of principle, yeah. I think there is a really good case for saying that people of beyond a certain age should not be given a right to make decisions that have an impact that, frankly, could considerably last beyond their lifetime, whether it's in a referendum or in a general election.
Mm. I mean, one thing that I thought about, and actually my wife mentioned this to me as well, she'd obviously been thinking about it when I mentioned we were going to have you on, and I mentioned about the piece that you'd written, was some sort of weighting. So rather than say, OK, older people aren't allowed to vote at all, you could say, you can vote, but your vote only counts half as much as younger people. I mean, I wonder if something like that might be a bit more politically acceptable. Admittedly, it would make things a lot more complicated in terms of the count and people trying to understand what influence they have, but at least then there would be some nod towards this idea of, OK, it's not going to affect us as much, therefore we don't get as much of a say.
I don't know. I like the idea, I guess, in principle. I don't know how it would work in practice. And look, in reality... Do I think that anyone will ever say that that older people should be denied the vote? No, of course, and there are loads of arguments on the other side, of course, saying, you know, that people have contributed throughout their entire lifetimes, they're knowledgeable and wise, and so on. And I totally get all of that. I'm not dismissing it. I think what is regrettable is that older people as a block have use their votes to the consequence of the way that they voted has been that their needs have been pandered to in a way that doesn't benefit the younger generation. You know, I'm struck by the fact that Ian Duncan Smith, who after all is presumably as close as it gets to a sort of poster child for the older generation, Ian Duncan Smith himself has written pieces about how the next generation are being robbed by the generations that have preceded them. There are plenty of bits of literature out there about generation rent and how unfair it all is for people under the age of 30, 35.
There's a very good book by David Willetts, actually former Tory cabinet minister, called, I think it's called The Baby Boom, How the Baby Boomers Stole Their Children's Future or something
exactly,
like that.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's plenty of literature out there about how unfair it is that the way that this voting bloc has been interpreted has led to the newer generation being disenfranchised and disadvantaged. You know, I'm lucky. I'm 45. You know, I got onto the property ladder at a decent time. It cost me rather more than it had the generation before mine. But nevertheless, at least I'm on it. You know, I look at some of the people entering the workplace today, and I think, well, how the hell are you ever going to get up the property ladder, particularly in places like London and the South East? You know, it's incredible the cost of property and the way that we treat property and property owning, which again is all to do with benefiting people who are over the age of whatever, who are property owners. And particularly who are pensioners, is unbelievable. I mean, it's unsustainable, and eventually it will have to stop.
Mm. A sobering point to end on there. Thanks very much for your time tonight, Gavin. It's been a fascinating discussion, I think. How can people follow you on social media?
On social media, I am at Longshanks1234 on Twitter, which is probably the best place, and Huffington Post, if they just search for Gavin Devine, Devine, then there's a few sort of musings and rantings there for all to enjoy.
Good stuff. We'll keep our eye out for that. OK, thanks for your time tonight, Gavin.
No worries.
OK, so that's Gavin Devine, senior executive within the PR industry, who's talking to us about... the differences in how generations vote and whether we should deny pensioners the vote, at least as a thought experiment. Okay, you've been listening to Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill. We talked to Sean Kemp, who was a senior advisor, special advisor to Nick Clegg when he was Deputy Prime Minister and for the Lib Dems, all about his time in Downing Street. And then we talked to Gavin Devine, senior executive in the PR industry, about the differential between turnouts between younger and older people, how that might affect the EU referendum, just as a kind of thought experiment, whether we could stop pensioners from voting. Nice little controversial subject to end on. I'm here every fortnight, so I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with more guests and more chat about current affairs and culture from a different angle. Thanks for listening.